So every 4 weeks, Finn's in, and we talk permaculture, and we've just decided to go through the design principles.
Or talk to at least what are the principles at like a really high level.
Yeah. So permaculture began, where was that, 70s, 80s?
1978, Permaculture 1 was published.
Okay.
So that, I guess, marks the formal launch of permaculture as this discrete thing.
But then in early 2000s, David Holmgren printed Principles and Pathways.
Yeah, 2002, 2003, I forget which one. Yeah.
Yeah, and in that there were new design principles.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, so previous to that, Bill Mollison, I guess, had kind of articulated a range of principles, if you could kind of call them that. But they were more like aphorisms, I guess, is how I relate to them.
That was more his style.
Yeah, yeah. And but they were kind of, you know, what I'd call heuristics, or kind of these... anyway, they formed, I guess, something similar to a principle. Things to think about when designing, I guess.
Yeah.
And I know we've talked quite a lot about designing and what that is, but... just to remind us when we're, or at least in the context I'm sharing about it, is I'm not necessarily talking about sitting down with a blank piece of paper and some colored pencils, or, you know, design doesn't have to be drawing, or it doesn't even have to be spatial, but it's a conscious decision-making process, I guess.
Okay, yeah. And so what was David Holmgren trying to, just briefly, what was he trying to achieve with the book and the new set of design principles?
So I think he was trying to provide a series of useful... He was creating a framework. So we've talked quite a lot about the permaculture flower, and the permaculture flower integrates the domains that, again, we've talked about at length, the petals, the seven petals of the flower, and the principles. And basically the idea is the principles kind of work through all of the petals. And so in this framework, one of the things he does is he tries to look at, well... how does nature design, and how should we think about designing with nature and natural systems? So the 12 principles are his attempt at trying to articulate how nature designs and how we can design with and in natural systems.
Okay, and so the first one we're going to talk about today is observe and interact.
Yep.
Is this the first one, or is this?
I think it kind of is. I mean, it's a useful enough one.
Did he order them? As
he did, but only in the sense of he published a book,
and they had to be by that in some order.
Know, in the English language, we read from left to right,
top to bottom.
So in that regard, yes, they are ordered, but they're not like numbered.
Yeah.
So, but
it's not a step by step.
No, it's definitely not. But I do think this one is a good one to talk about first, because it is in some ways all-encompassing, and it really challenges us to think in certain ways.
Yeah.
So having reviewed Principles and Pathways, again, you know, it's been published over 20 years ago, is I didn't really appreciate how much of a focus there was on, especially with this principle, on, you know, what's today known as kind of systems thinking, and more specifically design thinking.
So you've kind of reviewed the book recently, and
yes,
for this purpose,
and drawn on a friend of mine, a colleague who has in quite a bit of detail as well.
I like guests to come prepared.
Yeah, so I guess the other thing too is one of my goals, and hopefully we're somewhat successful, is how do we make this relevant to people who aren't necessarily specifically interested in permaculture or thinking about land-based systems or any of that stuff that permaculture is typically associated with. But how does, you know, the principles, and in this case, observe and interact, relate to everyday people in their everyday lives?
Yeah. Okay.
So I think that's what we can explore. And so each principle has a, you know, what I'd call like a whakatauki or a proverb associated with it.
Yeah.
And then there's also like an icon or an image to try to, I guess, distinguish them from each other. And for observe and interact, is beauty is in the eye of the beholder, is that proverb.
Okay. Is the proverb trying to sum the whole thing up, or is it a clue into it?
Yeah, it's a clue into it. So I guess beauty is in the eye of the beholder, for me, I really like, because it speaks to both the subjectivity of observation. And so one of the things I find, you know, and I don't want to oversell permaculture and what it is and what it isn't, but it does seem to have this incredible ability to stay ahead of the scientific curve, I guess, as it were. And so in some ways, this principle is speaking to what science has now caught up is there is no such thing as objectivity, you know?
Okay.
So the subject is... In an integrated part of the observation and comes with its own biases and values and assumptions that shape and influence what's being observed.
It's an interesting thing to say because objectivity, or the desire to get to an objective state, is core to the culture around science anyway.
Absolutely.
Even if the specifics of, like, I guess we're talking about quantum theory and things like that.
We are.
Which is making it clear that the observer is part of the process.
And so science is catching up with itself, right?
But, yeah.
But I think, you know, a lot of indigenous knowledge and design and other kind of systems disciplines that study nature intimately already, I think, kind of are way ahead of that scientific learning curve, is that they already know that. You know, they've already, through observation, know that the world is subjective.
You can't run a garden without being part of it somehow.
Yeah, that's right.
Or
other. I mean, in a garden, I guess you could think of, from an ecological point of view, is thinking of humans as a keystone species is probably the best way of conceiving of the garden as an ecosystem.
Yes. Yeah.
And humans' role in that.
Or an incompetent God.
Yeah, well, there's...
Because we try to behave like God in our local ecosystems, and then we keep messing it up.
Well, keystone species can either support ecosystems to thrive or, they're absent.
Or trash,
I guess, in this case, that's right.
Yeah, okay.
So I guess, so acknowledging that all, I guess, kind of... There is no such thing as an absolute truth. And so that's one of the things that this principle is trying to... communicate or articulate is observe and interact. Everything's relative and everything's contextual. And so we need to be active participants in our environments in order to understand them and see what's happening. And so, you know, we will often hear comments about, you know, jumping to that part about assumptions is some of the things that I'll often hear is people's positions or beliefs about the world or about certain organizations or entities. So common ones would be something like, you know, I'd call it nativism, but native is good, exotic is bad.
Oh, yes.
And again, I think the reality is much more nuanced, much more challenged or sophisticated than that. And, you know, another one
that's
would
be... That's the first thought we have when we discover or feel an urge to protect the environment. I think if we think, okay, if we can go back to how it was, it'll be okay. But
when you think about the fact that we have, you know, just looking at flora itself, is we have just over 20,000 plants in New Zealand today, different species of plants, and just over 2,000 of those are native New Zealand plants.
There's really no going back at this point.
No, and there is something to be said about, you know, invasive plants, and there are things called pest plants that are called that for a reason.
Yeah.
But that's just one example, right?
Yes.
And then there's other ones like growth is good, you know, just that assumption. Or GDP is, the higher the GDP, inherently the better the good that provides.
Yeah.
You know, and again, we've talked a fair bit about economics, but that's another one of those kind of assumptions that informs the way we see the world. And so we see, oh, our GDP increased, things must be going well. But what we're not looking at is, so what are the metrics? You know, so does that mean incarceration has gone up? Or does that mean hospitalization has gone up? Or does that mean that environmental degradation has increased and therefore the amount of money required to reinvest in that have gone up? It probably does mean all of those things. But it might not. But without looking at it in a more... interesting way, we dismiss things because we go, oh. And so I guess another one that I hear, particularly around here a lot, is some version of council is bad or corrupt or useless, or, you know.
Yeah, council's got it in for us.
Yeah,
yeah, that's, yes. Yeah, I feel, I actually, that one.
And did it just become, they limit us, I guess, is the thing there.
That one triggers me because I've got to know council so well now just through this job that I certainly know where their shortcomings are. But I can't talk about them in such an unnuanced way.
So, and I think that's it, is it's not to say that there's not truth in any of the stuff that I've just said, potentially, but to hold that as a position about the truth, about the way things are, is an inherently limiting... We're really limited in our ability to meaningfully act when our starting point is we already know what's happening.
Okay. Yeah,
if that makes sense.
So this is why we're talking about the principle of observe and interact.
That's exactly right. And tying it back to our conversations before around systems is, and just a little bit of theory is, you know, one of the frameworks that I particularly like is David Snowden's Kunefin framework, which talks about different types of systems, and we talked about that. There's simple systems. The language has slightly changed these days, but there's simple systems, there's complicated systems, complex systems, and chaotic systems. And I'm not going to go over all of that again, but essentially living systems, ecosystems, and systems involving humans are always complex systems. And his approach to how we need to think about and interact in these systems is we probe, sense, and we respond, which, again, I think is very much like observe and interact. So we act, we observe, and then we interact. Or, you know, so we act, observe, interact.
So indirect can damage things. I suddenly got this phrase in my head.
Yep.
Break things fast. Is that Mark Zuckerberg or Elon Musk? That sounds like Elon Musk.
I don't know.
There's a way to learn. Break things fast.
Yeah.
Which actually...
I think fail fast makes more sense to me.
Yeah. But he's been Elon. He's one of the tech bros.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But that's actually not very good.
Well, failing fast, and I think Observe and Interact is about that, is
failing fast,
there's a clear understanding of failure is good so long as we learn from it.
Yeah, but not looking to break things to find out more.
No, I would agree. I think that's very much an industrial... mechanical mindset.
Yeah.
Is, you know, we have to break things to learn. No, we don't. We have to observe to learn.
Yes.
Which is, again, what observe and interact is about. So your point about interacting is interacting can be bad, but that's why it's observe and interact. So as opposed to just...
dive in.
Dive in and muddle our way in. But what's interesting, so there is a little bit of a tension there between David Snowden's thinking about, you know, we first need to probe. So there's putting our toe in the water. We need to just kind of, because there is no such thing as subjectivity, we can't sit on the sidelines, observe and understand.
No such thing as objectivity?
Sorry, there's no such thing. Everything is subjective. There's no such thing as objectivity. We're all subjects in a large theater.
Yeah.
So we have to be active participants, but we consciously probe into the system. And so that's, again, something that this principle really draws on, is this idea that all systems are in flux and all systems are different. We need to, and sometimes that could be just sitting on the forest floor and observing, or, you know, it doesn't mean that we have to be boots and all into the system, but we're not separating ourselves from it. We're engaging with it in real time.
The funny thing is, this is something most 5-year-olds know.
Totally.
Most of us have learned by 5 that you dip your toe in first. You probe, there's a little less observation at that age, but still.
Well, it's maybe more intuitive.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, but they've just learned that from experience, and somehow we unlearn it.
Yeah, totally. I think that's, I want to share a quote because I think it's really connected to this. And this, So the thinking and design revolution of which permaculture is a part only makes sense when it reconnects us to the wonder and mystery of life through practical interaction.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in nature, animals survive and thrive by constantly observing, and they're using all of their senses to do so. But also in human cultures, well, in traditional cultures, certainly children learn to become competent adults by observing and interacting in environments shaped by kin and nature and culture. And so, you know, there's that recognition that, exactly as you said, it's intuitive. You know, the rest of probably all of life does it, certainly, but we can see it probably most readily in animals, to a certain extent plants, if one's observant enough, but we certainly can see it with children, eh?
Yeah.
How they just, as a, you know, no one needs to teach them to observe and interact. It's how they learn how to be a member of society.
Well, the first time they touch something hot, they learn that there are things in the world that bite back, and you've got to figure out what they are.
My daughter had that experience this
morning. Yes, I didn't mean to bring that up, but it just kind of came into the conversation.
And so it's that real world feedback. And again, if we are doing, and again, this I think is a good example, is that she did get burned, but she didn't sit on the wood burner. You know, she accidentally touched it.
Yeah.
And so this kind of, how do we consciously engage in a way where we're not going to get too burned, but when the system gives feedback, we're actually present to learning and readjusting and reorienting. And I think that's a key thing about this principle. It's as much a way of thinking than it is anything else. And it's a practice, really. So I guess it's both a cognitive process and a day-to-day, ideally moment-to-moment practice where you're constantly going, oh yeah, what am I bringing into this? What are my assumptions? What are the values that are clouding what I'm seeing here? Is there other ways? And then when you get feedback and people say, actually, I disagree with you, as opposed to shutting down or already knowing, you know, oh, they don't know what they're talking about, is actually taking a moment to listen and go, oh, I'd never thought about this situation from that way before. And then all of a sudden there's room there for my thinking to shift.
Yeah, which certainly her thinking probably has now, your daughter's. And it's interesting because we tend to think, oh, a terrible thing has happened, but also a good thing has happened. She's learnt about the world now.
A great thing has happened. I think she'll have a lot more care now around our wood burner in our house, which
is kind of
in the center of our living room.
At a relatively low cost, I presume.
Yeah.
Yeah, like you say, she didn't sit on it.
She'll heal quick.
It's something I want to bring in here, which I don't know you didn't plan for, but there's a book, The Continuum Concept, which we read when our kids were really little, and it was an anthropologist observing indigenous communities in, I think they were in South America somewhere. Mm. And they were really hands-off with the kids in terms of safety. Mm. This anthropologist, she'd reported a lot about her own reactions, and she said she saw a very small child with this giant knife and was about to freak out, and she noticed that there were lots of adults all observing and they weren't doing anything. Mm. And the kids learned very quickly about how to handle dangerous items from an early age. And you don't need to protect them from... You know, like our dog knows not to jump off a cliff. Mm. And our children are brighter than a dog after, I don't know how long exactly, I don't know when that crossover moment is, but after a couple of years. Mm. So
I would
think
say
in our culture, we stop our kids from interacting and learning about the world.
I would agree with that. And I do think there's other complexities there. You know, the more complex the system gets, probably the more... dangers.
Well,
so
yes.
For example, we live in a world now where, you know, things like fast moving cars on roads are an everyday thing, and no society has, or, you know, humans have not adapted to vehicles traveling at 50 kilometers an hour in residential streets, you know, as an example. So I think the system and the environment is a bit different in those situations, and the tools that they're using, well, have an inherent risk or danger, aren't immediately life-threatening. Whereas I think, you know, we've created a world that has that. And so, again, that's that part of that observe and interact is what risks are healthy and what risks are actually just too dangerous. And, you know, I guess that's a hard call for us parents to make on a, you know, day-to-day basis. And I guess as the kids get older, it's less intense. But, you know, when kids are small, is you kind of have to go, well,
yeah,
what degree of danger am I comfortable with? But I agree with you. I think allowing kids to learn by doing in reasonably low-risk environments is how, from what I can tell, how humans have always learned.
And that's how they're designed to learn.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is important to remember.
So I guess we've talked about it before, about this idea of, you know, observe and interact involves a two-way process between the subject and the object. And context is everything. So, you know, if I'd use the word designer, but if you replace the word with, you know, agent or person making decisions or taking action, is, you know, the subject there is the designer or the person, and then the system is the environment or the context or whatever it is. So for example, you know, a lot of my work is around facilitation and education.
Yeah.
And I do relate to myself as a designer. And so, you know, using this principle of observe and interact, a lot of in that role, in that kind of facilitator, educator role, my job is to observe and to watch what's happening in the space. And a lot of the time when things are flowing, my job is to kind of be present absent, you know, is to be in the space, still observing.
Not mess it up.
Yeah, that's it. And then there's other times where there is good reason to kind of intervene or redirect or sometimes just call out what I'm observing. And that allows the system to kind of recalibrate, or either it's individuals in the system or the system as a whole, to just kind of sense check and reorganize. And so I think for me, that's a good example of that kind of two-way process. Observe and interact means that I'm acting into the system in a way to try to help the system move in a positive direction.
And again, there's a subjectivity and there's values and all of that in what's a good direction. And we know that from politics, as everyone has a different view of what a good direction might be.
We're going to bring politics into permaculture.
Oh, we have to.
Should actually, if politics was viewed as a subset of permaculture, we might be better off now that I think about it. But let's not go down that route. I wanted to say, you bought a section in Raglan when you moved here.
Yeah.
And I have no doubt, without asking any questions, that you're doing permaculture-y stuff on it. Excuse the phrase. How did the observe and interact process work out? Was it a bare piece of land in a lot of ways?
It was. It was absolutely bare.
So not a lot to observe?
A lot to observe. Yeah. And so in some ways it's kind of interesting, because when you develop a property in the way we did, is it's largely blank canvas.
Yes.
And so we're not learning about what worked and doesn't work about decisions other people have made on the land, but we're having to make key decisions about where does a driveway go, where does, you know, where do structures go, where does energy systems go, how does water move through the landscape, how do we then tap into that and optimize that. So all of those decisions kind of sit on us. And so there's this kind of adage in permaculture around, you know, don't really make any key decisions until you know the land and have been on it for about a year.
Okay.
That's not always possible, right?
But that's important, though, because you're seeing it through all the seasons.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it makes it tricky. I mean, a good example is if you look back over the last 18 months or so, is we've had an unusual seasonal flow, as it were. And so I'm thinking particularly of last summer, when it was, I related to it more as like a warm, long winter, you know, which just kept raining. And so to make decisions based on going, oh, that's a Raglan summer,
that would have been a mistake.
A huge mistake, right?
Which this summer has, which still feels like we've got.
Yeah, that's exactly
it. Even though it's colder now this morning, it's still, we had a lot of beautiful weather for a long time.
That's it. And so...
Well, you probably don't call it beautiful weather, do you?
Well, it's just weather, right? But
okay, yeah,
But I do enjoy it, and I'm growing as many trees as I can right now, you know, thousands of them, so I also really enjoy particularly wet weather.
Yeah, wet and warm.
Yeah, that's right, because I still get the growth. So your question was around how does observe and interact play out when thinking about developing a site?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think for me it's, you know, even...
Oh, sorry, can we say how big it is, roughly?
Yeah, so I've got a 6-hectare block.
Okay, all right. Yeah,
so it's an uneconomical farm block by contemporary thinking, you know, from an industrial agriculture point of view. It's too small to be considered economically viable.
Because one person can't earn a yearly wage off it.
I'm guessing that's what the thinking is. I don't fully understand it, but I don't. I'm not an industrial agriculturalist.
That came up. I did ages ago. This presentation, well, not a presentation, submitted to council because they were changing their rules around what is the smallest block they can have, and that thing about being economically viable came up.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, a pot plant with a strawberry in it is economically viable. You just can't make a yearly income out of it, right? And there are people here, and you are no doubt becoming one of them, who earn a bit of money from their land but also have other jobs going on.
Yeah.
No, it's
And I don't see any reason from 6 hectares. I couldn't imagine us not being able to sustain our family economically on it. I can't imagine that situation.
That's not what you're going to do with it. You like to get out.
No, that is what we'll... I mean, we will basically... Our land will support us.
Okay. So, all right. So this is another discussion about what's... Yeah. So there's an attitude about... Well, I was talking about that it's not economically viable if you can't make a decent yearly wage off of it. But you're saying you can support a family off it.
Easily.
Because you're talking...
6 hectares, easily.
Yeah, because you're talking about nutritional density, I guess. In some ways. I don't know if anyone's ever used that phrase before, but...
Well, so there's an element of that, and I guess, you know, there's a few things here, and it is a bit of a parallel conversation, but I think it's worth having, is if... Observe and interact, right? If we're relating to a farm as a single product factory of sort, you know, where I produce one thing and I do that one thing really well, competitive advantage, you know, back to kind of Ricardo and it's neoclassical
it's part
economics.
Part of the bigger system.
Yeah, then basically I do that really well and then I sell my product and then I use the revenue I get from that to buy all the other things I'm not doing.
Yeah.
So I guess that's not a permaculture way of thinking about things, and that's certainly not our approach.
Yeah.
So we won't, I could imagine, ever be looking at monocropping anything.
Yeah.
Or,
no.
It doesn't have to be a crop, but producing only one output. It's about having a diverse range of yields.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which also saves you from having to go outside of the section, outside of the site to get a lot of stuff.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And that's the trick
there. I guess it's about one's goals, right? And again, this comes back to the observe and interact is, so my observations are based on a whole bunch of assumptions and values. And GDP does not really factor into my daily thinking. You know, I'm not, you know.
Yeah, okay.
And variants of that.
Point taken.
But, you know, what are financial metrics that determine health and well-being?
Yeah.
That's not really my orientation. You know, and I'm not dismissing the need for money. I guess I'm just saying I value other things a lot more than I value having zeros and ones on screens in a bank.
Yeah, yeah. And I must admit, I know a family with a very similar size section who went to the bank to get a loan and they had to produce their budget, and the bank didn't believe their budget. They said, you can't possibly live on that small amount of money.
Yeah.
But it was a full permaculture operation.
Yeah.
And they didn't have to spend a lot of money because a lot of the stuff was produced on site. Mm. And to the bank, that was confusing.
Yeah. Well, again, so that's that. So I guess it is a good example there, though, of how these assumptions and these values play into how we see the world and therefore how we act into it.
So part of your observe and interact is observing yourself and your values and knowing all those before you go in, which you should anyway. You should know yourself at that point.
Yeah. And so maybe an example there is getting back to the property is concept of being on a piece of land for a year before you make any decisions. Well, what are you bringing into your observations? What are you looking for? You know, are you looking for where frost happens and where water pools, or are you looking at other things around, you know, where animals that come on site like to make home, or how much, what are annual flows of water in the local stream, or, you know, there's any number of things that you can be observing, and the more of those that you can take into account, the better you'll understand your site in relationship to a larger living system.
So what are you learning from when animals come onto the land, where they hang out?
Well, so it depends on what it is, but from what I learned from where the ducks come, or even the plovers when they come, they're building nesting sites and what they're territorial. I learned different things from where the I got a mind blank.
Well, where they nest, or where they
magpies is what I was thinking of. Yeah. So or even the patterns of the kahu in terms of when they circle over and where. And then we brought animals onto site too. So then there's a whole other thing there is, where do the chickens like to hang out when they free range and under, you know, and it's kind of interesting. They choose different spots. Where do the ducks? The ducks have different habitats and different likes as well. And so I'm learning different things by watching both wild animals and more domesticated animals move through the site.
So are you learning where, if I'm going to pen them in, this is a good place to pen them in? Or is it a bit deeper than that? You're learning by where they are, what plants would also go there.
Yeah, so there's elements, for example, with the ducks is by watching them nest, I'm learning about what their wants and needs are for raising ducklings in spring.
Yeah.
And so the more I can pay attention to that, the more I can recreate an environment that is conducive to them safely being able to rear ducklings without... you know, we've had a lot of loss
this last
spring.
I've heard that ducks are notoriously bad at raising their chicks.
That's right. And so there's something around how do you design systems that kind of allow you to play a secondary parental role to try to help ensure they get through.
Yeah.
And so that's an example there, I guess, of just by observing where they're naturally wanting to nest, then we can recreate that.
And from all this, do you also discover where the house should be?
To a certain extent.
Well, there's data for where the house should be.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yep. Yeah. So there's things like, you know, we're in Te Uku, so prevailing winds and storm winds are really important. And, you know, we're reasonably high. Our site is quite steep, I guess. It has quite a lot of elevation. And so, so things like wind are really important. But then also hydrology and how water moves through the landscape impacts on where we might build, and then even just things like contour and where do we have relatively flattish land so we're not having to do heaps and heaps of earthworks to accommodate that.
Yeah.
Proximity to waterways, types of soil, even just what kind of building materials do we have on site? So what's the quality of the clay? You know, we live in Teuku. In theory, one would assume that, you know, we could earth build quite easily.
Anywhere around here?
Yeah. Yeah. But is that actually the case, right? And so in terms of... so then there's also considerations around sun aspect, you know, and wanting to have as much as possible really extensive sun exposure into the house.
Yeah.
And so that affects things like orientation, but also location. You know, if there's large trees around or kind of steep valleys or gullies, they're all going to create shading.
Some of the stuff, you know, instantly you walk on site, right? Okay, there's north, there's some trees, the hill's going that way.
That's right.
I can see the wind's going to come up the valley.
Yep.
But the rest of it over a year or even probably 10 years, actually.
Well, our thinking's changed over the last year and a half about potential house sites.
Right. Okay. So, are you living on the site at the moment?
We are. Yeah.
Not in a house, obviously.
Well, we are, but we're in a tiny house. So we've intentionally built in a very sheltered part of the property until we learned. We didn't want to make big decisions about investing, you know, that amount of material and financial capital into a house without being fairly certain that that's the right place for the house.
Is the rest of the family on board with the permaculture approach of taking a year or two?
Yeah, well, I guess it's kind of our life way. It's kind of how we've lived as a family prior to. Karen and I, prior to having kids, that was kind of our way of orienting ourselves.
She knew what she was getting into anyway with you, no doubt at all.
Absolutely.
I remember meeting you 15 years ago. It was only permaculture was going to probably by that point already was the only way you were going to do things. So.
Well, I mean, that's true and it's not true. So I do like to think that I think outside the permaculture box quite a lot. But permaculture is still a really good orientating framework for me, and I haven't come across anything that is as holistic or integrative.
Yeah.
Whereas what more likely happens is I come across new frameworks or ways of thinking or seeing the world, and I integrate them into my permaculture worldview,
which is
as opposed
kind
to
the
other
of the
way
point.
Around.
Just kind of the point of permaculture.
Well, that's what I think is so great about it.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. It's not a religion. It's not, and I think they worked very hard at the start to try to make sure it didn't turn into that prescriptive.
Yeah, I mean, different people have different views, and I don't have a particular position, and I don't feel any need to kind of justify or... I would say there's definitely people out there who still think it's some kind of pyramid scheme or cult or... and I do think that also...
None of the people in it think that.
No, I would agree with that. No.
Yeah.
But you also have very dynamic personalities. So you had someone like Bill Mollison, who was kind of the face of permaculture for decades, who was incredibly charismatic. And
he's a salesman for the for
he
the
totally thing. Was. Yeah. Whereas, you know, David's quite a humble kind of... Yeah, he's got a very different approach. You wouldn't hang out with David and kind of go, oh, wow, he's a guru. or he's, you know...
He's not the guru in that charismatic sense, but he's a guru in the knowledge sense, and I'm sure he's treated like that now.
Well, he's revered, I guess, because of... But he's you know... Anyway, he doesn't have that same... what I say is the truth. He's kind of like, well, listen to me if you want. And I've learned to listen, because what he has to say is usually, you know, there's a deep wisdom in it.
Yeah.
But he's not trying to sell anything, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so...
So even from the start, the two personalities were very diverse...
Yeah, which is I think why they went their separate ways pretty quickly after Permaculture One.
Yeah, but it's also and that's sort of permaculture thing. The meeting point where they met was a very fertile place.
Incredibly, and even just from again that observe and interact. David's often gone, why was it that a kind of eccentric Aussie kind of pseudo academic and a young university student were offered to have a first publication published so quickly? You know, most authors get books turned down all the time, and yet Permaculture One got picked up right away and printed, you know, kind of mass run. What was happening outside of, you know, just two guys sitting down and writing a manuscript? There was something else happening. And so he takes that observe and interact point of view even to that level to go, what was happening? Why was the ground so fertile that people went, yeah, let's publish that. That sounds great.
Yeah.
And because, you know, there's a recognition there that permaculture didn't emerge in the absence. You know, it didn't come out of nowhere.
Yeah.
It was part of a larger movement and part of a larger thinking space, I guess. You know, there were people who were starting to realize that the promise of industrial capitalism had limits, and people need to start thinking through how do we address those limits, because we're going to hit them sooner or later.
Yeah.
Hence, you know, a whole range of different things emerged at a similar time.
Yeah, yeah. Folks, we are talking to Finn Mackesy, permaculturist and local resident with a mod. I don't know. I'm not going to call your product your property a model permaculture property. That's unfair, no, isn't it?
It is. And untrue. And we're a year and a half into our journey.
Well, yours will be the perfect model for that specific site. And it won't be a model that can be used anywhere else, because
I'm not even
point.
Convinced of that. We're going to make decisions, and I'm hoping we make reasonably good decisions.
Yeah.
But I don't know about the perfect. But yeah, we're in the process of trying to develop a fit for purpose functional site that restores, that kind of acknowledges what the land wants to be and how, yes, that system wants to regenerate itself, and do that in a way that's going to serve our family and our wider community. So in that sense, I guess maybe it might be a bit of a model, but I'm not sure about the perfect part. Yeah.
I think with permaculture, it's a process, not a model. I think that's the whole point of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And the whole point of observe and interact being the first, you know, first thing.
Yeah. And so we've done quite a big deep dive today, but hopefully it sets the scene for conversations to come.
What's the next? Have you worked out the next one?
I think we'll just go through in the order that David presents them. So, okay. Catch and store energy.
Okay. Cool. All right. Well, we'll do that in a few weeks' time.